The reading is from Isaiah 9, verses 8 to 10, verses 4. The Lord has sent a message against Jacob. It will fall on Israel. All the people will know it. Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria will say with pride and arrogance of heart, "The bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with dressed stone, and the fig trees have been felled, but we will replace them with cedars." The Lord has strengthened Rezin's foes against them and has spurred their enemies on. Arameans from the east and Philistines from the west have devoured Israel with open mouth. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. But the people have not returned to him who struck them, nor have they sought the Lord Almighty. So the Lord will cut off from Israel both head and tail, both palm branch and reed in a single day. And the elders and dignitaries are the head. The prophets who teach the lies are the tail. Those who guide the people misled them, and those who are guided are led astray. Therefore, the Lord will take no pleasure in the young men, nor will he pity the fatherless and widows, for everyone is ungodly and wicked. Every mouth speaks folly. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. Surely wickedness burns like a fire. It consumes briars and thorns. It sets forest thickets ablaze so that it rolls upward in a column of smoke. By the wrath of the Lord Almighty, the land will be scorched and the people will be fuel for the fire. They will not spare one another. On the right hand, they will devour but still be hungry. On the left, they will eat but not be satisfied. Each will feed on the flesh of their own offspring. Manasseh will feed on Ephraim, and Ephraim on Manasseh. Together they will turn against Judah. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. What will you do from the day of the reckoning, when disaster comes from the altar, from afar? To whom will you run for help? Where will you leave your riches? Nothing will remain but to cringe among the captives or fall among the slain. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised.
Well, good morning, everybody. If we've not met before, my name is Tom Simpson. I'm one of the staff team here at St. Matthew's. Do keep that passage open from Isaiah chapter 9. It's not the most straightforward passage in the world, but I think it's really helpful, and I think it really speaks to our world today. So let's see what we can see. Now, sometimes people like to make fun of Christians. They look at how we live our lives and say, "Well, why do you bother trying to follow God's rules?" They point to their own lives and say, "Well, look, I'm free from a lot of your kind of boring rules. I'm having a great time. You should just ditch the God stuff and come and have some fun. Come see what life is really about." And I guess we might look at people like that and think, "Well, they're not following God's ways, but God hasn't, you know, struck them down with a thunderbolt. You know, the sky doesn't turn dark red or stop shining when someone sins as a sign of God's displeasure." And we can think, "Well, is God bothered if people don't follow his rules or his way?" And sometimes we can think that God is a bit like the parent who makes lots of rules for their children but doesn't enforce them. You know, it's all very well telling them that you know, you've got to put your shoes away or brush your teeth or whatever it is. But if there's no consequence for not doing it, well then, what's the point? What's the point of having that rule in the first place? And we can read the Bible and say, and hear God saying, "You should put yourselves second and others first." But if we look around us and see lots of other people putting themselves first and not suffering as a result, well, then it feels like we're the ones who are losing out. So does God care? Does he mind if we don't follow his ways? Well, if he doesn't mind, then, well, should we just shut up shop here? Should we just, go home? Well, before you stand up and leave, let's have a look at these words from Isaiah 9 and 10. Because we'll see that God really does care how we think, how we act. And in fact, he's got some quite shocking words of warning. This isn't a particularly cheery passage, but it's something we must hear. Because those who ignore his words face a bleak future. It was true then, it's true now. God is going to bring judgment on those who sin. Now, Isaiah is speaking to the nation of Israel, which is the bit in yellow at the top of this map of the Middle East from the time. It's a people who initially did follow God's ways, but have turned away from him. They lived to the north of Judah, who you'll also see mentioned in the passage. They're the ones in green, if you can't read the names. And Judah is the people that Isaiah is speaking to most of the time. Now he's speaking to the people in yellow, to the north. And the Israelites, they have been fighting against the people of Judah. And over the last few chapters, over chapter 7 and 8 and the first part of chapter 9, Isaiah said that Judah is going to be saved from Israel's attacks. Now Isaiah brings a message from the Lord to Israel. And the message is that there is danger ahead. Watch out! There is danger ahead. Israel's attacks on Judah have been stopped by Judah's ally, Assyria. And if you want to find out more about what's gone on with that, go to the website, listen to the last few weeks' sermons. That's what we've been talking about over the last few weeks. The Israelites have been defeated. They've been beaten up. But now they're picking themselves up again. Look at verse 10. They say, "The bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with dressed stone. The fig trees have been felled, but we will replace them with cedars." They may have lost, but they're trying to build back better, to borrow a phrase. They think, it's been really bad. We've suffered all these defeats, but it's okay. This gives us the chance to sort things out properly. Rather than just plain brick, they're going to put up some fancy marble, nice dressed stone, that make it look really nice. And out in the gardens, well, let's get rid of those cheap fig trees. Let's get some nice cedars there. That'll look really impressive. It's the same idea that if something bad happens to something we own today, maybe your phone gets broken or stolen, you think, well, it was a few years old anyway. This gives me the chance to get the latest model. They think their misfortune has passed. But Isaiah's got some bad news for them. Look down at verse 11. "But the Lord has strengthened Rezin's foes against them and has spurred their enemies on. Arameans from the east, Philistines from the west have devoured Israel with open mouth." Things are only going to get worse for them. This isn't going to be a time for building back better. No, this is going to be a time of further attack. Those people, the Arameans who are the red ones, and the Philistines who are the rather fetching pink, they're going to attack Israel. They're going to come and swallow them up. And this isn't an accident. This is the Lord's work. He has strengthened Rezin, who's the king of Aram. He has strengthened his foes to attack them. It's God's work. But why would God want to do this? Look back at verse 9. "All the people will know it. Ephraim," that's another name for Israel. "Israel and the inhabitants of Samaria, the capital city, who say with pride and with arrogance of heart, dot, dot, dot." Verse 10. They are proud. Israel thinks they're in control of the situation. They've been planning all sorts of things against the Lord and against his people. And they think they're going to get away with it. They've stood up to God and say, hey, we know best. We know how things should go. Not you, God. You don't know. We know best. But it will not last. God is going to bring judgment against them. But even this moment, even the guys in pink and the guys in red coming to attack them, that won't stop God's anger against them. His hand is still raised for a blow of judgment. Now, I guess Isaiah's day feels quite distant. You know, it's kingdoms who battles that happened 2,500 years ago. But while the situation might seem distant, people haven't changed. Because actually we're all a bit like the Israelites. Our hearts and minds, our attitudes are still the same. We still all have that same pride. We never need to teach people that they think they know best. It's something we all have. If you've ever been around small children, you'll know that you don't have to teach them to say, I want. And miraculously, they learn it by themselves. People don't follow God's ways because we think we know better. But it will not last. All things in the end will come under God's judgment. That's something that's a message that runs throughout the whole Bible, whether in the midst of the lives of these people in this particular moment, or at the end of our lives for all of us, or if Jesus comes back again. There's danger ahead from God's judgment for the Israelites, just as it is for all of us. And as verse 12 says, it won't stop there. There's more to come. The Israelites have turned away from God, and so God is going to leave them to the consequences of their actions. God's judgment will lead them to bad leadership. Now, when disaster happens to Israel, there's going to be a problem. These bad things happen, but as verse 13 says, the people have not returned to him who struck them. Nor have they returned to the Lord Almighty. If you've been with us over the last few weeks, we've seen this before in Isaiah. Disaster happens to people, but rather than turn to the Lord, the one who made the world and rules over it, they go elsewhere for wisdom and understanding. Because they turn to the wrong place for answers, they look to leaders who can't help. So God brings further disaster to them, taking away those elders, those dignitaries, those prophets, those people who are just pointing them in the wrong direction. You know, it creates a situation where the kind of blind are leading the blind. It's as if all those in government were suddenly taken away and we're left following a load of social media influencers and TikTokers. You know, we probably end up with some very highly rated content and a lot of likes, but it's not the ones I'd want running the army or the NHS. It's why Isaiah says in verse 16, those who guide this people mislead them, and those who are guided are led astray. It's going to create disaster. And shockingly, it's only going to get worse. Look at verse 17. Therefore, the Lord will take no pleasure in the young men, nor will he pity the fatherless and the widow, for everyone is ungodly and wicked. Every mouth speaks folly. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. It's not just that God is going to look down and reject the young men, those who are portrayed as strong. He's going to turn away from the fatherless and the widow, the weak, the ones who can't help themselves. As we read these words, it should be hard to it feels shocking. God's care for the lowly, the outcast, the fatherless, the widow, particularly those who couldn't care for themselves, was a key feature of why God was great, of his care for everyone. Yet this sin, the sin of this nation, turns God's face away from them. God is patient with people who don't follow him, but not forever. Rebellion against God will lead to his judgment against these people. And the absence of God is truly terrifying. It doesn't just destroy our leadership. It leads to social collapse. That's what the next little section says. Look at verse 18. Surely wickedness burns like a fire. It consumes briars and thorns. It sets the forest thickets ablaze so that it rolls upward in a column of smoke. By the wrath of the Lord Almighty, the land will be scorched, and the people will be fuel for the fire. They will not spare one another. Now, over the last few years, we've seen lots and lots of forest fires in the news. Images like this have been all too common, where everything is on fire. The whole hillside is on fire, burning out of control. And that's the image that Isaiah draws on in two different ways to describe the wickedness of people who have abandoned God's ways. There's the fire of God's anger that burns against these people and their evil. That's verse 19. But it's also the burning of their own evil. These people have turned away from God, but rather than leading to happiness and freedom, it leads to evil and wickedness. It's like a fire that burns and consumes. Their wickedness and evil means that they throw their fellow people onto the fire. It's shocking. But that is how Isaiah warns these people. He makes the same point with a different metaphor in verse 20. On the right, they will devour but still be hungry. On the left, they will eat but not be satisfied. Each will feed on the flesh of their own offspring. Their desire to turn away from God turns these people into cannibals. Probably not literally, but metaphorically. They eat one another to advance their own evil. You know, this is the true consumerist society where they literally consume each other to satisfy themselves. The fabric of their society kind of collapses downwards. It's the survival of the fittest, everyone for themselves. I guess, so the world around us so often looks at our Western kind of heavily Christian influenced society and says, well, it would be so much better if we could just remove that influence. That actually, if we got rid of all the Jesus stuff, if we got rid of all of kind of God's ways, well, then it would be so much better for all of us. Yeah, then we could really look after ourselves, put ourselves first. But Isaiah says to his people then and to us now that if we turn away from God's plan for the world, if we become a self-first society, then the problem is that we will put ourselves above everyone else and squash and consume everyone else. Take away any reason to put others first, and disaster is only a short way ahead. Isaiah's presenting a bleak picture, but he's not done yet. He's got one more verse of this particularly depressing poem to go. Because now we reach the conclusion as we start chapter 10. His conclusion is that God's judgment means no earthly hope. If a society is all about putting ourselves first, then whoever gets into control is going to change things for their advantage. We see this in dictatorships all the time. The dictator gets into power, sometimes by legal, sometimes by illegal means. And then one of their first moves is to remove, is to change the rules so that it becomes impossible to remove them. Whether that's declaring a state of emergency or refusing to recognise an election result or changing the number of years they can be in power for, you know, that sort of thing. And it's the same in Israel. Chapter 10, verse 1. Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. As I was highlighting how their society has crumbled to the point where justice disappears. And this is going to bring them under God's judgment. Throughout this section, there's this continual kind of spiral downwards of people turning further and further away from God, leading to more judgments. And so Isaiah finishes with a series of questions, which you'll see in verse 3. What will you do on the day of reckoning when disaster comes from afar? To whom will you run for help? Where will you leave your riches? All of this power that they've accumulated, all these people that they've consumed to get ahead, how's it going to help them? What good is it going to do for them? It's not going to bring them any help. They can't turn aside God's anger against wickedness. They're going to suffer the same fate as everyone else that they've crushed to get ahead. The thing about turning away from God is that all it does is leave us under judgment. There's no escape. There's no second chance or get out of jail free cards. Is God bothered about whether we follow his rules or not? Well, most definitely. This is his world and it plays to his rules. And if we break those rules, whether back in Isaiah's day or today, we stand under God's judgment. Now, each of our little verses has finished with that line. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. God's hand is pictured raised up like a boxer drawing back their arm, ready to strike again. God is bringing justice to the world that he made. He is punishing sin as it deserves. Now, all this might sound shocking and extreme. We so often don't think of God in this way. But I think there's a couple of things we need to realize. And if you don't remember anything else from this sermon, this is the key thing. Our horror at these verses, at the way that we find them kind of repulsive, it says something about us. It says that we don't take sin very seriously. We think that God treats sin as kind of mildly humorous, like a parent who tells off a child but is struggling to keep a straight face while they do it. But the exact opposite is true. God's opposition to sin is total and unbreakable and implacable. He is angry against sin, not in the wild rage that you or I might experience, but anger in its purest form, controlled and deliberate opposition. God hates sin, and he will remove it to purify his world. And that includes you and me. So is there any hope for us? Can anything lower the hand of God raised in anger? Or just because God is totally opposed to sin and totally committed to justice, it doesn't mean that he's unloving. He hates our sin, but he loves us sinners. And so he's made a way that his hand can fall in judgment on sin, but also not crushing us. And that's because he made his judgment fall on Jesus on the cross, on his own son. Jesus died on the cross to bear the awesome weight of God's judgment, a weight that you and I could never bear. He died so that we can be free to enjoy God's goodness, so that sin can be washed away, can be dealt with. when Jesus cries out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? He is bearing the weight of this, of God's judgment that is described in passages like this. That's how terrible it is. But the wonder of the cross is that it falls on Jesus so that we can be free, so that we don't have to suffer in that way, so that God can be just and deal with all the bad things and the sad things and the wrong things of this world, everything that happens that we look at and are so sad about. But we can know that justice will be done and that wrong things will be punished, but that God doesn't have to crush us in the process. We're free. For all those who trust in Jesus, we are free because God has balanced his justice and his opposition to sin with Jesus' death on the cross. Now, this is the beautiful dawn at the end of a bleak passage, because God will bring justice. He's appointed Jesus to bring judgment one day. But those who trust in Jesus for their salvation can know that the punishment that they deserve has already been paid for, that their weight has been lifted at the cross. As one of Jesus' followers in the New Testament would later go on to write, Jesus cancelled the record of the charges against us and took it away by nailing it to the cross. God takes sin extremely seriously. We must never underestimate this. But let's remember that God is merciful and loving and has made a way for broken, sinful people to be restored and remade, nailing their sins to the cross.